Well, I'd like to come to this Bible study period this morning in the spirit of the old poet who wrote about the Bible. Though the cover is worn, and though pages are torn, and though places show traces of tears, yet more precious than gold is this book worn and old that can shatter and scatter my fears. This old book is my guide, 'tis a friend by my side. It will lighten and brighten my way, and each promise I find soothes and gladdens my mind as I read it and heed it each day. To this old book I will cling, of its worth I will sing, though great losses and crosses be mine. For I cannot despair when surrounded by care, while possessing this blessing divine. And in that spirit, I'd like to turn to the 90th Psalm this morning and read with you the psalmist singing again about his God, and through his words, exult with you in what God is at the beginning of this new day. Yesterday, we talked about the 139th Psalm, God is everywhere. Today, I'd like to talk about the 90th Psalm, God is every when. The eternity of God. Like the other Psalms, this too is a hymn divided into its own strophes or stanzas. In this case, the first six verses comprise one stanza, the psalmist looking at life and God, and then the next six verses, 7 to 12, and then what I think is the key verse on which the whole psalm kind of turns, a kind of a hinge of Psalm 90:12, that many of you know by heart, and then the last five verses. There are just 17 verses in this great psalm. If one were to put a topic over the first stanza, I think we'd say this: time is so short. And it's against that backdrop that the psalmist sings that God is eternal. Lord, thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever thou hast formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. Thou turnest man back to dust. And many of you who are pastors stand at that point many, many times in your life when you say quietly, earth to earth and ashes to ashes and dust to dust. And you know what it is for this mortal body of clay to be turned back to dust. Well, Moses knew that. This is the only psalm that Moses wrote, as far as we know. But as you notice from the ascription, the 90th psalm is ascribed to Moses. And I guess generally scholarship concurs with that ascription. What occurs there is above the line of inspiration, you know, when we say who some of these psalms came from. But this apparently is the psalm of Moses. And one is sobered to think how often he stood by the body of some dear friend and laid him to earthly rest. How many people was it that came out of the land of Egypt with Moses to make their way to the promised land? Well, I guess the scholars are still guessing about that. 1.5 million? I guess that's what I take as a kind of a round number. 600,000 say some, 4 or 5 million say others. But these slave people that came out of Egypt, 1.5 million. And how many of them actually got into the promised land at the end of those 40 years? Joshua and Caleb and the children, some of the children. And through 4 decades, every day, I suppose, Moses buried another of his friends, usually in the sands of the desert, to lay the body down and then heap over a scoop of sand until you had just a mound of sand there in the desert, or to dig one's way into a cave in a mountainside and to put a body in there and roll a stone over the hole of the cave, and that became the tomb. And day after day, Moses knew what it was to see God turn men back to dust. And I suppose over those years he had a chance to reflect upon the significance of those swiftly passing years and the eternity of God. And out of his many soliloquies, standing by the final resting place of some friend of his in the sands of the desert, he could think about the thing that he's singing here. Well, thou turnest man back to dust and sayest, turn back, O children of men, for 1,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday when it is past, or as a watch in the night. Thou dost sweep men away. They are like a dream, like a grass renewed in the morning. In the morning it flourishes and is renewed, but in the evening it fades and withers. So here in stanza one, he's saying, time is so short. And if you relate that to this pivotal text in verse 12, teach us to number our days, these swiftly passing short lifespans of ours. Teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom, because time is so short. Or in stanza 2, because sin is so great, for we are consumed by thy anger. By thy wrath we are overwhelmed. Thou hast set our iniquities before thee and our secret sins in the light of thy countenance. Now all of us who are here today are probably here not overwhelmed with any great sense of sin like the psalmist was as he stood there by the graveside of another person and thought of the import of life and of the weight of sin upon a man who's going now into the presence of an eternal God. And we've been cleansed and redeemed in the blood of Christ, and we stand here deserving to be in hell, as our brother prayed and said in his prayer a little while ago, but cleansed because of the mercy of God. I've never forgotten reading what Walter Wilson, the medical physician, wrote in one of his books on personal witnessing, Let's Go Fishing with the Doctor, when he talked about how he tried to approach what he called self-righteous people, people who didn't feel any burden of sin or any need for a Savior because they were pretty good after all. When they looked at other people in the world or other people in America, why they were pretty good. And they didn't feel this burden of sin. And Walter Wilson said, then he would ask a self-righteous man, well, do you suppose that you have committed one sin this day? Just one little sin in what you've thought or what you've said or what you've done. And he said, I've never met anybody yet so self-righteous except he would say, well, yes, some little thing, yes, I'm sure I've done that once during the course of the day. And then Walter Wilson would begin with that open door and say, well, let's see, one little sin a day in a year, that's 365 sins upon your soul. In a decade, that's 3,650 sins upon your soul. In a lifespan of 70 years, that's 25,350 specific sins upon your soul. And then said Walter Wilson, maybe if it were 3 or 4 sins a day, and you'd have to multiply that 25,000 by that, maybe you've got 100,000 sins upon your soul. And do you mean you want to go into the presence of God and stand your chances in the judgment bearing 100,000 sins upon your soul? Well, this is a little bit how the psalmist is saying, the secret sins of my life, they're all in the light of his countenance, and he's very aware there in the presence of death that he's a sinful man. All our days are passed away under thy wrath. Our years come to an end like a sigh. The years of our life are 70, or even by reason of strength, 80. Yet their span is but toil and trouble. They are soon gone and we fly away. My father died a little while ago. He lived more than these 70 years. He lived 15 years. He died just short of his 95th birthday in a nursing home up in Alexandria, Minnesota, alert and well up until his 91st or 92nd year. But then the ravages of time took hold of him and his body began to give out and one function ceased after another. And he knew what this lifespan of toil and trouble is like. One night I drove up to Alexandria just to spend an hour or so with Dad and to visit with him. And when I came in, he wanted to tell me about a vision that he just had. He said, I dreamed that I had died and my life was all over on earth and I had gone to heaven. And he said, I was walking down those golden streets in heaven when a man was coming toward me, and I couldn't quite make out who it was. And he said, I looked at him, but I couldn't quite tell who that was. And my dad had cataracts, and he couldn't see anybody. He never knew who I was when I came until I started to talk to him. So even in his vision, he couldn't quite recognize the people who were coming toward him here in heaven. And he said, till I got right to that man, and then I discovered it was Jesus himself. And Jesus turned to me and said, Henry, is that you? Dad was almost 95. And the Lord said to Henry, Henry, I didn't expect you to be here so soon. And then Dad said, I woke up and I discovered I was right here in Alexandria. And he said it was the biggest disappointment in my life to discover I was still here. Well, he was living through some of the psalmist experience, 70 years, and so many of those closing years of infirm age, years of toil and trouble and despair and heartache, the ravages of sin upon our lives, if not our own sin, the sin of the human race. Sin is so great. Therefore, O God, teach me to number these days, to acquire a discerning mind, as one of the version says. Well, who considers the power of thy anger and thy wrath according to the fear of thee? So teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. Well, that's stanza 2. Sin is so great. Now then he comes to the last stanza, and here what he's singing is, God is so good, therefore teach me to number these days. Return, O Lord, how long? Have pity on thy servants. Satisfy us in the morning with thy steadfast love, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad as many days as thou hast afflicted us, and as many years as we have seen evil. Let thy work be manifest to thy servants, and thy glorious power to their children. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish thou the work of our hands upon us. Yea, the work of our hands, establish thou it. Well, you heap all of this together. God, have pity upon us, satisfy us, show us thy steadfast love. Let us rejoice, let us be glad, make us glad. Let thy work be manifest, let us see thy glorious power. Let the favor of the Lord rest upon us. And then you sense that God is very good to us. Well, this is a great psalm to sing. Lord, teach me to number, to treasure, to husband, to guard, to invest wisely these years. Or in terms of modern parlance, God, help me to be a good manager of my time. Because time is so short, and because sin is so great, and because you are so good. Well, now, it's in that setting, then, that the psalmist looks at God who exists every when. Lord, thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever thou hast formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. And his word here is like God's word to Moses, tell the people, I am, have sent you. Like Jesus' word in the Gospel of John, before Abraham was, I am. And you can only say this of God, who is timeless self-existence, which is what we mean by his eternity. You see, when I say Carl Lundquist is, I always have to add something to it. Carl Lundquist is here, or Carl Lundquist is feeling well, or Carl Lundquist is going home today. You always have to add something to that. When you come to Jesus, the eternal Son of God, he just says, I am, period. And he doesn't have to add anything to that. And that's what the psalmist is saying here. Before the mountains were brought forth, thou art. The great God who is eternal, timelessly self-existent. The French version of the Bible translates the word Jehovah, the eternal one, l'éternel. G. Campbell Morgan, in one of his early volumes on one of the Old Testament books, discusses the meaning of the word Jehovah and draws out of its etymology the fact that the word Jehovah binds all of time into it, the God who was and is to come. And it's all in the name of God, Thou Art. When James writes about him, he talks about looking unto the Father of lights, with whom is no variableness, neither shadow caused by turning, the turning of the sun, of the earth on its axis around the sun, so that there's a shadow on the sundial. God is not like that, because God is just eternal and always the same. Behold, says Isaiah, as he quotes God, I am the high and lofty one who inhabitest eternity. Well, it's all of this that the psalmist picks up here. Thou art God. Well, now what do we mean by the eternity of God? To the psalmist, it became significant because he saw it over against the transitoriness of men, the temporality of men, as versus the eternity of God. That's how this first stanza all holds together here, on the shortness of time here. And so he heaps up the figures of speech. You turn man back to dust. You say, turn back, O children of men. 1,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday, or they're like a watch in the night. Or thou to sweep men away like a dream, or they're like grass which grows in the morning and flourishes and is dead by the end of the day. So our 80 years go by rapidly like that, like a watch in the night, and the first thing we know we're awake, or like grass in the morning which at the evening tide has withered and decayed, or like a dream that suddenly is all over. This is life, this transitory life we live, the years going by so rapidly. And that picture we have of Father Time really is not a very good metaphor of the passing of the years, because we see time as a little baby born at the beginning of the new year that we celebrate in some great New Year's party in our church, and we see him all dressed in his naked body with a little ribbon over him, 1975, and the year is born. And then the year just slowly goes by until that little boy grows older and older and gets a long beard and has a sigh in his hand, you know, and Father Time kind of creaks his way out at the end of the year. And it seems like time is just moving by so slowly. That's our picture. No, says the psalmist, the years are just going by like a dream, like grass, like a watch in the night. And Crane's picture that hangs in one of our art galleries entitled The Chariot of the Fleeting Years is probably a better picture, in which he pictures time as a chariot in the heavens being driven by several steed of horses with a driver standing on the pedestal in front of the chariot on tiptoe with his whip out over the horses, and you can almost hear him shouting to them, faster, faster, faster. And more of us feel that time is like that. And the older we get, the swifter, more swiftly these years go by. And some of the people who just feel breathless because the years are going by so fast are my friends who are retired. You know, from where I stand, it seems like life must be going awfully slow, you know, when you get to be 70 or 75. But for these friends, those years are going by faster than ever in most cases. These years multiplying. Most of us trying to live two lives in a single year. Most of us trying to do more things than we ought to be tackling, to be sure. And so the years go by faster and faster and faster. Well, it's against this, then, our breathlessness, that one is just glad to see that God is eternal. Thou art. Well, what do we mean by the timeless self-existence of God? He's eternity. Let me suggest three things out of this passage. In verse 2, Thou art God. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever the earth and the world had been formed, Thou art God. By this we mean that in His eternity, God has no beginning and no ending. Stephen Charnock, the old Puritan theologian, in his big book, as big as a dictionary, called The Attributes of God, talks in one long chapter about the eternity of God, and in it he talks about the unbeginningness and the unendingness of God. But this is a part of his eternity. He has no beginning and no ending. And this is a This is a great truth from the Scriptures here. And it's another one of these almost incomprehensible pictures of God, because we don't have anything like it in our experience to make it very clear to us. I remember my friend A.W. Tozer, great saint and prophet and burr under the saddle in the Christian Missionary Alliance for many years, and under the saddle of the whole evangelical movement in America, trying to talk about the difference between time and eternity, which is just as true here. He said, if you try to take this line across the front of the pulpit here, make that all of time there is, you know, from whenever God created time way back there in the past to the consummation of the ages when Christ comes back again and sets up his kingdom and time shall be no more. Here's all these millennia of time. Then he said, find your 70 years in it, you know, make a little pinprick here somewhere, and even that's too big for your 70 years in the light of this relatively here, but here's where you are in time, that little pinprick on all these millennia. And then he said, you think of God not just as an extension of time in the future going out forever here, that here's time and then here's eternity beginning and going on, but he said when you think of God as in his eternity as related to man in his temporality, you have to see God not just as an extension of time, but you have to see God as a kind of an elliptical orbit that engulfs time. And it goes way back here in time past, so you can't see the rims out there. They disappear in the past. And it goes out here into the future, and you can't see the rims out there. They disappear into the future. And here's God. And here's time, and here's your little 70 years. And Thomas Kelly, in his just great devotional classic on the Christian life, A Testament of Devotion, talks about living in two worlds simultaneously. He says you don't live in the world of time now, in the world of eternity, when time ends. But you live now in this world, subject to all your 5 senses that you can touch and see and smell and put parts of in a test tube and shake up. And you're living in this world by your 5 physical senses. But at the same time, you're living in this world of eternity by this 6th intuitive sense of faith, until God and heaven and the soul-rapturing exercise of heavenly contemplation is... Baxter puts it in his little book, The Soul's Everlasting Rest, The Saint's Everlasting Rest. All of this is very real to you, and you live in this other world of eternity simultaneously with this world of time. You live in two worlds at the same time. And for the Christian, this is a very real experience. Like Moses, he's very aware of this world and its mounds of sand in the desert, and he's very aware of God, who is eternal and to whom he's sensitive to and with whom he's in right relationship. Well, this is God in his eternity, who engulfs time and extends beyond time in all directions. God has no beginning and no ending. That's a part of this great revelation here. And it's a blessed source of assurance to us who are time-bound creatures in our life. Now, that's what it means quantitatively, that life with God goes on endlessly once we've come to know him by faith in Jesus Christ and we've been given eternal life. But eternal life for us that comes to us through God, who is eternal, has not just this quantitative dimension, it has a qualitative dimension. And the Scriptures keep insisting that eternal life is the kind of life that's worth enduring forever. It's not just life projected on infinitely. And I've never forgotten reading something that George Bernard Shaw once said in one of his writings. He said, the thought that George Bernard Shaw might go on living forever is utterly appalling to me. And I guess it would have been utterly appalling to some of the friends of that gloomy skeptic in London as well. But he'd put his hand on something, that this kind of life that we know, unredeemed and unregenerate, is not worth going on living forever. And eternal life is not only quantitative, it is qualitative. And all of this is caught up in a perfect God who is eternal and endless because of a quality of God-like life that is worth lasting forever and ever. Well, God is endless, has no beginning and no ending from this standpoint. Now, a second truth from this first stanza of Psalm 90 is that God in his self-existence is not only without beginning and without ending, but God is not marked by any succession. In verse 4, he says, 1,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday when they are past. And that's what time is, duration marked by succession. And we have all through the years tried to find different ways to mark time. And so we know our earth is turning on its axis 15 degrees every hour. And anywhere where there's a sundial, that shadow is lengthened on the dial and moves on the dial with the turning of the sun. And with each degree it turns, we mark off another hour. That's succession. Or we list it by years. And so we say 1975 of all the years that there could be. Or even in the days of Christ, they measured time by the founding of the city of Rome, AUC, Ab Urbe Condita. And Jesus, you know, was born, ironically, in 4 B.C., but in 70 A.U.C. We find something to peg onto because life is constantly moving, and this is what time is, just this duration marked by succession. Now, God is not time-bound like that. God is timeless and is not marked by succession. And one of the old theologians, it seemed to me, had one of the most wonderful ways of picking this up, this 1,000 years that's like a day when it's past. Who was the other theologian who said, you know, nobody's even lived a day yet in the sight of God in terms of this? Peter picks this up in his epistle in the New Testament, you know, and says these 1,000 years are like a day. Well, that means that that when we have lived one day here on earth, it's infinitesimally small to God. 1,000 years are but as yesterday when it is past. One day, 1,000 years, 365,000 years in this equivalency to our 1 year on time. And if you multiply that out by our 70 years, well, the contrast becomes impossible to get a hold of. God and man. So one of the old theologians, trying to make it very practical for us, said it's like two boys going down to see the parade. One boy goes down with his dad, and he gets right up to the front of the parade line, and there's a whole crowd there, and he gets into somebody's yard, and there's a fence, and he stands behind the fence, and here's a picket fence, you know, 2 inches of space, and then 2 inches of a picket, and 2 inches of a face, and the dad gets up there and tries to get a place for his boy, so he stands there with his legs in a big V, and the little boy gets between his dad's legs here and looks out at that V, and he's got 2 inches to see there, and then the elephant comes by and he sees 2 inches of the elephant's trunk, and then 2 inches of his ear, and then 2 inches of his tail, and he's seen the elephant, and then 2 inches of a tiger, you know. And 2 inches at a time, this little boy sees the parade. His friend is the son of the president of the First National Bank of that city, and his dad goes to his office, which is up on the third floor, overlooking a corner of the street. And they go to a window there and pull out some comfortable chairs and sit in front of the window. And here the little boy looks out of the window, and he sees the whole street. He sees the beginning of the parade. He looks down the blocks. He sees the whole parade. He even sees the end way down there. And he sees it also as it comes up toward him. He's seeing that elephant in part and in whole and in the light of all the rest of the parade. Said this old theologian, that's the difference between the way man sees life and God in his eternity sees life. We just see it 2 inches at a time. We've had an argument with our wife and we haven't gotten over it. Or a deacon has accused us of something unjustly. Or we've just lost our job. or one of our stocks that we were depending upon for retirement has given way to the Dow Jones averages. And we see 2 inches at a time, you know, and we're dismayed and distressed. And all the times of the theologian, God is looking down in his eternity, and he sees the whole parade. He sees all of our life, the beginning and the end. He knows now how it's going to turn out. He can guide us safely at this point. He sees it all. And one of the devotional writers says, from the standpoint of his eternity, God has already lived all our tomorrows. And another writer said, God is never late for anything. Because he's eternal, and he picks up all our little 2-inch spans of life in his eternity. He's not marked by succession. Or, by his eternity, we mean that God has neither beginning nor ending. God is not marked by succession. And we mean that God contains in himself the source of all time. Because it is possible, when you see the transitoriness of life, the fleetingness of these years, to stand by that mound of sand in the desert and say, it's hardly worth it. Life is hopeless at its best. And we can be like Plato, who deprecated time as a philosopher. Because only the things that endured were significant to him. And one can deprecate time, and any of us can oftentimes be guilty of this, until you recognize that in his eternity, God also comprehends all of time and is the source of all time. It was in the fullness of time that Jesus came, born of a woman, made under law. God, in his eternity, had a purpose for time itself and a plan for time and for your 70 years, more or less, in that segment of time. And all of this is caught up in the purpose of God. How was it Charles Wesley wrote it of this eternal God? God compressed to a span, incomprehensibly made man. God's purpose for these 70 years. And time takes on a holy significance then in the light of the fact that God has some purposes in them for all of us. Did you ever read Nathan Wood's book with the somewhat pretentious title, The Secret of the Universe? It was a book he wrote when he was the president of Gordon School of Missions, the precursor to Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary and Gordon College. And it really is just a great book. It comes out of another era, another day. But he talks about the imprint of God upon the world that he made. And he sees this eternal aspect of God. In fact, he sees God as a Trinity, just written big in his handiwork everywhere. He sees the Trinity in God's universe, and time and space and matter are all reflections of the triune God who made time and space and matters, our universe. And then he sees the Trinity in each of these units, past, present, and future, you know, energy, motion, phenomena, length, height, breadth. He sees the presence of this Trinity everywhere in life. Well, when he talks about time and God, he says that that time begins for most of us in the future, and we begin in the past, and it's when these two come together, time and ourselves, we have a split second we can get a hold of that we call now. This is that succession, you know. When you think of something, you say to your wife, boy, it's 6 months, and then I'm going to go to Los Angeles and attend the National Association of Evangelicals. And then you say, it's a month from now, I better start getting my reservations in. And then your wife says, boy, it's only an hour until that plane goes. Why haven't you packed your underwear, you know, there? And time is coming closer to you. And then you say, I've got to leave now. The convention starts tonight. And then it's now. And then suddenly you're saying, boy, that was last week when we left Los Angeles after that mountaintop experience. And then you report to your church, a month ago I attended the National Association of Evangelicals and had a great time. And then you're saying some night to your wife, boy, it hardly seems possible that 10 years have gone by since I was there at the International Hotel. But time has been moving like that, going from the future to the present to the past, as Nathan Wood. And we've been coming out of the past. We were born back there, you know, 1930 or 40 or 10, and we've been coming this way toward 1975, and if the Lord tarries and gives us strength, we'll go to 1976 and 78 and 80. And it's when time coming from one direction and we coming from the other meet for that split second, we've got now something we can get a hold of, and then it's gone. The old Greeks who used to anthropomorphize everything, they had a picture of time, too, of opportunity. And their picture of opportunity was a picture of an old man coming toward you, out of the past here, but coming toward you with one lock of hair in the front of his head, and just a bald head in the back here. And their thought was that as opportunity came, you had to grab him as he came by, or once he got past you, there was no hair left to get a hold of him, and then opportunity was gone. And now is like that, you know. You seize it now, or it's gone, and then you get further and further apart, and you can never retrieve those nows again. This is that succession that marks us. Carlyle is the one who picked all that swiftly passing now up and called God the eternal now. This now that's appears and then is gone forever for us. That's picked up and expanded and caught and goes in both directions to eternity, past and future. And that's God, the eternal now. And that's the one with whom we have to do. Well, it's a great picture, this picture of an eternal God, timeless self-existence, without beginning and without ending, unmarked by duration, containing within himself the source of all time. How do we respond, then, to God who is eternal? I think the only way we can respond is the way the psalmist ends this 90th psalm, with his prayer. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish thou the work of our hands upon us. Yea, he repeats, the work of our hands, establish thou it. Lord, it's not enough to live my 70 years in time before you who are eternal and end it all up with just a little mound of sand in a desert. It's not even enough if I had a pyramid and was wealthy enough to build a great monument that could endure, eroded by the rains and the storms and the winds of time and finally to dwindle into insignificance. It certainly is not enough to end life with a hole in a rock in the side of a hill, and that's all that's left to say, I live for 70 years with a God who is eternal. O God, the work of my hands, establish thou it. I want to throw my life into more than just General Motors that rises and falls with the passing of the years. I want to do more than build automobiles, important as they are in our day. I want to give myself to something that's going to endure and have significance and last eternally. God, wherever you put me down in our secular world to make automobiles, help me to do it with a vision of representing you, of living for you in ways that are going to last much longer than those automobiles that sometime will end up on a junk heap at the edge of a city somewhere and compacted and sent off to war. Lord, you're eternal and I'm transitory. But God, will you establish the work of my hands?